Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process, hosted by Edward Willett. This episode's guest, John Scalzi. Welcome to The World Shapers. I'm your host, Edward Willett. I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy, and this is the podcast where I talk to other authors of science fiction and fantasy about their creative process, how they go about shaping the fantastic worlds that they create and the characters that inhabit them. My own books run the gamut from young adult science fiction and fantasy to adult science fiction and fantasy. I also write a lot of nonfiction, but won't talk too much about that in this podcast. My latest books include The City Born, a standalone science fiction novel published by Daw Books, and World Shaper, which is the book that gives this podcast its name, which is coming out, or has come out, depending on when you listen to this, on September 18th, 2018, and will launch a new series called World Shapers. I also have a young adult fantasy series called The Shards of Excalibur you might want to check out from Cato Books, and it's out in audiobook as well. You can find it on Audible with Elizabeth Klett doing the narration. And a couple of other recent projects have included my short story collection, Paths to the Stars, published by Shadowpaw Press, and my illustrated collection of science fiction poetry, I Tumble Through the Diamond Dust, which came out from Your Nicholsworth Publishing and is also available as an audiobook. Well, that's enough about me. You may even think that's too much about me. Let's get on with what you're probably really here for, which is my conversation with this episode's guest, John Scalzi. I'll give you a brief introduction. John was born in California in 1969, currently lives in Bradford, Ohio. He studied philosophy at the University of Chicago, which is where he also began his freelance writing. He wrote film reviews. He was a newspaper columnist for a few years. 1996 was hired by AOL. That would be America Online, for those who may not know what those initials stand for anymore, as its in-house writer and editor. And he wrote his first novel, Agent to the Stars, during that time in 1997 and published it free on his website in 1999. And it was later brought out by Subterranean Press. His first published novel, Old Man's War, also appeared first on his blog. He serialized a chapter a day in 2002, and Tor Books purchased it, publishing it commercially in 2005, and it did okay. It went on to win the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, and since then, John has won other awards, including the Hugo, the Locus, the Audi, the Seyun, and the Kurd Lasvitz, which is not what I'm familiar with, plus the 2016 Governor's Award for the Arts in Ohio. His work regularly appears on the New York Times bestseller list for fiction, and he still remains involved in the film and gaming worlds. He's a creative consultant for the Stargate Universe television series. He's the writer for the video game Midnight Star from Industrial Toys, and, very exciting, executive producer for Old Man's War. I told you it did all right. And The Collapsing Empire, his newest book, both currently in development for television. He served as president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America from 2010 to 2013. He's married, has a daughter, and several pets, some of which may interrupt this podcast at some point. Welcome aboard, John.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, we first met at the World Science Fiction Convention in Toronto in 2003, which was after you'd written Old Man's War, but before it came out and before my first novel had come out for Daw. And I've been trying to think what the topic was. It was something like things you could do to make money as a writer when you couldn't actually make a living as a novelist or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was something like that. And in fact, not only were we on the same panel together, you are literally the very first person I met in science fiction and fantasy besides my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden. And I remember specifically because what happened was I went to the airport to go from Dayton, which is the nearest airport to me, to Toronto. And I was so excited. And I told the person, I'm going to Toronto. And they're like, that's great. Did you bring your passport? And It turns out that Toronto is actually in a completely different country.
Yeah, little known fact, yeah.
Little known fact, you know. And so I had to go back home. I didn't have a passport, but back in the 2003, you could still cross the border at land by using your birth certificate. So I basically drove from my house to Toronto. I arrived like 15 minutes before our panel. I zoomed into the panel. Just sat down, like, super exhausted. I was like, I can't believe it. I just barely made it in time. This is my first panel ever, my first convention ever. And I think either you or someone else said, great, you're the moderator.
It wouldn't have been me. I was more likely to volunteer to be the moderator. Well, I'm glad that, you know, meeting me that early on didn't turn you off of the science fiction and fantasy world forever.
No. It was a good first meeting. And so every time I see you since then, I actually have a very good positive association with you. So well done you.
Oh, well, thank you. Now, what you may not know, and I didn't realize it until I was reading this, was that we probably came closer to meeting than you might think before that, because about the time you were at AOL, I was actually writing books like Your Official America Online Guide to Creating Cool Web Pages, Your Official America Online Guide to Internet Safety, and AOL's Picture This Fun and Easy Photo Projects. And for that last one, I don't know why, they flew me down to Washington, D.C., and I went to AOL headquarters to meet the editor I was working with, a fellow named Brad Shepp, and you may have been in the building at the time. Who knows?
Probably I was. I was there from March of 96 to March of 98. And then after that, I did contract work with them basically for another several years. So it's entirely possible that I might have seen you in the hallway and just didn't know at the time.
Yeah, well, obviously your precognition had failed you at that point.
I'll work harder on that.
Yeah. It takes practice. So a little bit later on, we're going to focus on your latest novel, The Collapsing Empire, which I read and enjoyed very much. But we'll go first a little bit further back in time. How did you first become interested in science fiction?
Well, I was reading science fiction since I was a little kid. So, I mean, that was one of the things.
And, do you remember any of the books that...
Yeah, the very first science fiction book that I actually remember reading, and this was back in the third or fourth grade, was Farmer in the Sky by Robert Heinlein, which I think was a pretty good, at the time, pretty good introduction to science fiction. I think Heinlein had done a smart thing by writing so many of the juvenile books that he did to make it easy for younger folks to kind of step into that. And then when I was reading it, it was the late 70s, so there wasn't a huge gap in time-wise. It was about 25, 30 years since he had written the book, but as far as it went, it still spoke to me pretty well. And then I just basically kept it up since then. When I got to the point where I was in my 20s and I decided that I was going to write a novel, just basically to find out if I could write a novel, I had to decide between writing science fiction one or writing a mystery one, because both of those genres I was comfortable with sort of equally. And what I ended up doing literally was flipping a coin, right? I was like, flip coin, if it comes heads, then I'm going to write a science fiction novel. And if it comes up tails, I'll write a mystery novel. And it came up heads. And I always kind of wonder, you know, it's a weird sort of inflection point where if it had come up tails and I decided that I was going to write just kind of a straight up contemporary murder slash crime book, how much different my life would be, because so many of the people that I know and like are in science fiction. And so I would not have met you, Edward Willett.
Probably not.
And, you know, other folks that I care about now. So I think it's kind of interesting that this is one place where I can literally say my life changed on a coin flip.
Well, of course, there is, if you buy into the multiple worlds hypothesis, there is another world in which you did exactly that. You could perhaps write a science fiction novel about the you becoming a mystery novelist in an alternate universe. Might not be very interesting, but you could write it.
Right. You can write anything you want. It's the question is whether there'll be an audience for it. But, you know, the good news about science fiction is that it is capacious enough that you can end up writing whatever you want. And so, as it turns out, I've written a couple of I've basically written a couple of murder mysteries in the science fiction genre, Lock In and Head On being the two that I'm thinking of.
It's something that Isaac Asimov did in his Black Widow. Is that what they were called? The Black Widow Club. He wrote science fiction mysteries way back. I remember reading those as a kid.
Yeah.
Because like you, it was largely Heinlein. Although the very first science fiction novel I can remember reading was Revolt on Alpha C by Robert Silverberg, which he wrote when he was 19, which is really annoying. But considering he's still going strong.
Yes, indeed.
So you didn't write fiction until later, but you started writing before that. So when did you actually just start thinking you could do things with words?
I can tell you specifically, which was there were two events. One, when I was in sixth grade and a teacher asked me to write a letter to a local news station or the news department of a local TV station because he wanted to get publicity for something that he was doing, and he thought it would play better if one of his students had written the story about it. And I remember him specifically saying, I want you to do this because you are good with words and it's something that I think that you'll be able to do and that they'll respond to. And so that was the first time that someone pointed out, hey, you know, words are something that you could do. And then in ninth grade, I was part of an English composition class at my high school, and there was an assignment, which was a short story, meant to be a short story, that was about gifts, about a gift that you give to someone, the consequences of the gift, and so on and so forth. And I originally wrote something terrible, you know, Twilight Zone-esque sort of thing about a black cat being evil and all that sort of stuff, but that didn't really work out very well for me. So I ended up literally at the, you know, last night typing up a story about my friends getting together. So it was a true life story, lightly fictionalized. And the gift that they gave was their love for each other, which was so sweet. I know, right? And it turns out, you know, that this was the only story in three sections of the class that ended up getting an A. And the thing was, is like I literally wrote it in the last minute. It was just like, you know, slam it together, off it goes. And it worked really well. And then it occurred to me that, hey, this writing thing is something that I can do relatively easily, that I get positive attention for, and that not everybody can do, while literally everything else, math, history, you know, whatever, was difficult. And so at the age of 14, I was like, that's it, I'm going to be a writer. Because clearly, you know, the principle of least effort for maximum return came in. Now, the disappointing thing for me later was to find out that writing isn't, in fact, easy, that you do actually have to work at it. But by that time, it was too late. I had already gone too far down the path. I couldn't back out now.
It's still easier than hard physical labor.
Oh, yes. I mean, and I tell people, it's like, I have literally no other skills. The only thing else that I would be good for is to be a Walmart greeter, right? It's like, welcome to Walmart. Can I see your receipt? Okay, thank you for coming. Other than that, I'm in trouble if I need another job.
Well, I had a summer job at the Weybert Inland Grain Terminal, shoveling rotting grain at the bottom of the legs, as they're called, which is what lifts the grain up to the top, right. And coopering boxcars, which is putting up walls so that you can put grain into a boxcar. In, you know, 30 degrees Celsius heat, 85, 90 degree heat. And that's when I decided, you know, this whole writing thing I'm focused on, I think that was the right choice.
I agree with that. I agree with that 100%. It's the idea of, you know, all work has value, but I'm glad that some people do other work and I get to do this.
Exactly. One interesting note for me was that at the University of Chicago, you studied philosophy, of all things. Has that played into your writing over the years and the work you're doing now?
I think so. I mean, I think in two ways. One, the philosophy degree in and of itself does not have a whole lot of real-world utility. But one of the things it does teach you to do is to learn how to learn, learn how to question, learn how to think about things beyond the, you know, first step of you know, whatever's going on. So you think more deeply about things, which I think is useful when you're writing, particularly science fiction, which, you know, we like to call science fiction the literature of ideas, but I think really what it is the literature of consequences. This really cool thing or this really cool technology happens or aliens come. And it's not so much about the aliens arriving or robots coming, but the consequence of those arrivals that we write about in science fiction. So writing a literature of consequence like we do, I think the philosophy degree really comes in handy. The other thing that it's useful for, again, is just to let your mind wander and think about a whole bunch of different stuff and then be able to make connections between that initial thought and something else that would appear seemingly random, but as it turns out has deeper rooted connections, which again comes in very handy if you're a writer, to be able to see connections that other people won't necessarily see. In terms of the philosophy degree, I mean, I sort of fell into it in the sense that at basically in my third year of college, I had to get serious about which degree it was that I was going to take. And I went and I looked at everything. And if I had decided to go on to an English major, I would need an additional year of school, which would not be a great idea because I was super poor and University of Chicago wasn't cheap. Or if I had a philosophy, if I pursued philosophy, because I had been taking so many classes about it, I could already graduate. So I was like, well, you know, philosophy it is. Now, one of the things that's kind of a fun story is that very briefly, because I was going to do a particular philosophical examination, I had Saul Bellow as my thesis advisor for maybe about a month. And it turned out that it was not a good time for either him or me. He was getting prepared to move to Boston University, I think. And then I was also, I had just been picked to be the ombudsman for the university, which was going to be a full-time job. So I ended up going with another advisor. But it's always a fun little story. It's like, oh yeah, my thesis advisor, Pulitzer Prize, or you know, Pulitzer Prize, Nobel Prize winner, Saul Bellow, no big deal.
Yes, it's interesting the people we encounter along the way that later you think, boy, I didn't. Wow, that was really something.
Yeah.
So we'll start talking a little bit about the Collapsing Empire specifically, but also your writing process in general. What typically provides you with the seed from which a novel grows? And then specifically, what was the seed for The Collapsing Empire? But in general, how does that process work for you?
What I tend to do is, and this is kind of along the line with people, that it's like, where do you get your ideas, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the ideas are not the hard part. It's distinguishing which ideas are the good ideas and which ideas are terrible. And so what I tell people is that I think about, you know, I have an idea and I'm like, and I don't write it down. And if I remember it the next day, then I'll be like, okay, then that's maybe something I want to think about more. And then a week later, if I'm still thinking about it, then I think about it more. And then a month later, and then a year later, and so on and so forth. And so it's kind of a vicious process, partly because I'm absent-minded and forget a lot of things anyway. So for something to stay in my brain, it really has to be sort of interesting to me, at least. And the thing I was thinking about, honestly, was ocean currents, right? With respect to the European colonial era from about 1400 to about 1800, which is that so much of European colonial imperialism was predicated specifically on the fact that there were ocean currents, that there was the jet stream that they could get from one continent to another carried by the ocean waves. And what would have happened to European colonialism and consequently the rest of the world if the jet stream hadn't have been there? And so with that as sort of the basis of just sort of casually thinking, I wasn't going to write a story about colonial times because that's a whole lot of research and a whole, that's basically a time commitment that I wasn't necessarily interested in pursuing. But I did think about that, well, how do I take that concept and move it over to space or space opera particularly.
Perhaps this would be a good point to give a brief synopsis of The Collapsing Empire for those who foolishly have not yet read it.
Yeah, what are those people thinking? Well, basically, The Collapsing Empire is the idea is that there's a galaxy-spanning human civilization that's called the Interdependency. And the Interdependency is connected not by faster-than-light drives, which I think are physically impossible, but by this sort of extra-dimensional plane that is called the Flow. And you can enter the Flow, and because it is not actually part of the our universe, it does not have to adhere to our rules. And so you can basically transport very quickly relative to distances and so on and so forth, and end up in another star system like a month or 2 months or 9 months later. And because of this, this civilization has flourished for over 1,000 years. And when the book begins, we're beginning to see evidence that these that the Flow, this basically transport system that people are taking for granted, like a river or the ocean currents, is essentially drying up, that it's shifting in some way, which means that all of the civilizations, all of the human outposts are going to be stranded from each other and not going to be accessible to each other. And that's a problem because most of the civilizations are not on planets themselves, but on habitats, and are not in and of themselves wholly self-sustaining. That's why it's the empire is called the Interdependency. And so what will happen to humanity, basically, when this transport system that they took for granted just suddenly disappears on them? Are we all doomed? What can we do to save ourselves? And that's sort of the crux of the matter for The Collapsing Empire and subsequent books, which will be coming out later.
Yeah, I found the Flow really interesting because, of course, you're a longtime science fiction reader, and you know that there is that peculiar challenge if you want to write about an interstellar anything. How do you get around that speed of light limitation? And it often amounts to hand-waving.
Sure.
I did like this. I actually wrote this down because you explain it so well. The Flow is a multidimensional brain-like metacosmological structure that intersects with local time-space in a topographically complex manner, influenced partially and chaotically, but not primarily by gravity. I liked that sentence.
I had fun writing it, too. But I think it's true. I mean, one of the things that I think is important for science fiction to do is to acknowledge the science that we do know. And one of the things that we keep seeing over and over again through various tests is that the speed of light is a constant, and it's described very well by Einstein, and that it really is a hard limit. And so if you want to have a civilization that spans star systems, you have to find a way around it, either with generation ships and the understanding that, you know, you're going to be a spacefaring culture for thousands or tens of thousands of years, or something that sounds plausible, even if it is highly, highly, highly speculative, like, for example, the Flow.
Well, one interesting thing I found is that, of course, your solution to the problem is also what drives the plots. And I don't know that I've seen that before. So that was very interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, and I think, but that is the thing that was interesting to me, like I said, because when I first started casually thinking about ocean currents and the influence that they had, and just the fact that certainly European colonial powers at the time just took for granted that the ocean was there and worked in particular ways. And yes, you could be becalmed, like, for example, in the Sargasso Sea or whatever, but ultimately, they knew that the routes worked, that things worked in predictable ways. And like I said, when humans are confronted with natural things that actually don't care about humans' plans one way or the other, how do they deal with that? And for example, you know, with The Flow, The Flow does not have any concern about humanity whatsoever. It has no interest in people, has no interest in people's plans. It's just a thing that exists. And if it goes away, it goes away basically on its own sort of whim. And the fact that people have been using it as a, in the sense of, well, this is, has always worked before and it's always going to continue to work, and I've not given thought to the consequences of what if it goes away, I think is fascinating. Because, and again, it has parallels in the past for humans, and it has parallels in our present as well.
With the this sort of general setting and your idea of the interdependency, you basically had a setting. What from that, and I guess the beginnings of a plot, but what from that drove the characters? How do you find your characters within your setting and idea?
In this particular case, I basically started from archetypes. I knew I needed somebody who was going to be at the very top of the food chain, sort of being able to look at everything. And so that's why you have the Impero, who is the emperor, or the empress in this particular case. I knew I wanted somebody who could be sort of eye level, and that's where we get Mars, who is the scientist, who is able to understand and describe what's going on, but is close enough to everyday person's experience that you could follow what he was doing. And then I wanted to have somebody in between who is kind of a wild card, who could basically move between both of those poles. And that's where we get Kiva Lagos, who is the who basically runs the starship that goes from End, which is the planet that Mars starts on, to Hub, which is where the Impero is. So I started with knowing that I needed those three sort of archetypal people in those particular positions. And then I started thinking about what their personalities would be. With the Impero, Cardenia, I wanted her to be sort of new and naive, not only because I think that's more interesting than to have somebody who's comfortable with the immense power that she has, but also, again, to help the readers kind of get into the character so they could feel some empathy and sympathy for her. So that was one thing. I knew that I wanted Kiva basically to be a sarcastic badass, because that sort of person always enlivens things to, you know, move things along in a sort of a quick and entertaining fashion. And Mars basically gets to be exposition lad, the guy who explains things, because you do need something, particularly when you're talking about, as you mentioned in that sentence, metacosmological brains, right? If you're going to lay that on people, you need somebody there to translate it. So, so starting with those basic concepts, both in terms of archetypes and just sort of general personality types, then you drill down and you use your skills as a writer to actually make them seem like real people.
Well, I have to say, I love both Cardenia and Kiva, and I have to say that Kiva's has one of the more memorable first appearances of a character in the book, which we won't describe in detail because this is a G-rated podcast.
Of course.
But she, you know, and I thought at first, well, ugh. But she certainly grew on me, and by the end, she was actually one of my my favorite characters. So, and I loved Cardenia, too, and I like that sort of thrust into this position, and her kind of attitude toward it was very refreshing from a, you know, as you say, somebody who's accustomed to power and was expecting to have it. So I thought those worked very well.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm a huge fan of all the characters, which is nice because I have to write them.
But it always helps.
I can say that writing Kiva in particular was just a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, and it was one that it was a character that, you know, going in, basically from the very first time she comes on scene, that people are either going to really like her or they're going to really hate her. And I'm okay with either. But I do feel that people feel sort of binary. There are very few people who just kind of are like, eh, about her. And those are fun characters to write. And you have to be careful with characters like that, because if you're not careful, they will have a tendency to take over the entire book. And you want to be very careful about that. Characters like Kiva are the spice rather than necessarily the main dish, right? And so it was really hard for me to keep from creeping it out to be, you know, this is all about Kiva just because I'm having so much fun writing her. It's like to use Shakespeare, it's like Falstaff. Falstaff is great in the Henry plays, but then he's the main in Merry Wives of Windsor, and it doesn't quite work as well. So you have to be aware of how you use your characters.
One thing, go on.
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say one thing that struck me when you talk about you started with the archetypes and built out from there is that that strikes me as a somewhat filmic approach to setting things up. And you do a lot of work in film and television. You've been a critic, and you're also now executive producing the TV series that are in development on your own books. Do you think that your long interest in observation of film ties into the way that you plot and write your fiction?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Old Man's War, which is a which was the first book that I got published, it's very clearly cinematic three-act structure, right? And the reason for that is that was a storytelling grammar that I got used to, not only from obviously watching films, but being a film critic, every film that I saw as when I was a film critic, and I did it professionally for 5 years full time and another 10 years after that part time. Basically, I had to explain why is this story working, how does it work, how does it doesn't work, break it all down to component parts and be able to explain it. So in many ways, my storytelling school was not really novels, but it was film, because novels I could read and just read them for entertainment and not really be thinking about them in terms of how they were working and how they weren't working. But for film, every single film I saw, I had to put a critical eye to. So when it came time to writing, certainly that was a very, very heavy influence on the way that I structured story. Not only that, but if you've read any number of my books, then you know how dialogue heavy they are. Mm-hmm. That so much of the story is covered by people talking or people saying things. And again, that is the thing that comes through film grammar. One of the funny things was when I got my agent, Ethan Ellenberg, and I sent him Old Man's War to read, and then also sent him Agent to the Stars. One of the first things he asked me was, did you write these as screenplays first and then make them into novels? And the answer is no, I wrote the novels. But I absolutely understood why he was asking that question.
That's something else we share. Ethan is also my agent.
Yes.
Does that then, you're now, as I noted, executive producing these the development of these TV series, will you be writing scripts, do you think? And does the fact that you have this kind of cinematic background make it easier to adapt them to a video framework?
It does, but I don't know that it does in the way that people think, right? I'm not primarily doing the writing, and I think that the reason for that is since I don't actually have concrete experience writing scripts, they're very unlikely to just sort of hand it over to me in that respect. We can say, hey, we want to write the script, and they may give us a pass on it, but then what they will do is just hand it over to somebody else and say, okay, go and, do it. And so for me, I'm not really going to worry about that too much. But the way that it does help me is that I understand, because again, having been a reviewer and having looked at adaptations of books into film, it made me, when it was my turn to basically sell the options for work, it gave me a healthy perspective on what was going to happen with the book. The very first time I spoke to one of the producers about Old Man's War, this is way, way back, about 8 years ago when it was initially option to be a movie, and they put it, and it was at Paramount. I talked to one of the producers, and the producer was a very nice woman, and you could tell that part of her job was to handhold nervous authors. Mm-hmm. And she was like, "Everybody here loves the book. Everything, everybody is so committed to it. We're so excited to be doing it." And you know, after she appropriately buttered me up, she then said, "Well, but you also know that we are going to have to make some changes." And I was like, "Yes, of course you're going to have to make changes. And here are some of the changes that I suggest you make." And I rattled off three things that I think that they would absolutely have to change from the book in order to bring it into the movie. And she was, after I was done speaking, she was like dead silent for about 5 seconds. And then she said, "Oh my God, I can actually talk to you about this." Because I knew going in, it's like, look, we're going to have to adapt it. It's not going to be the book. It's going to be something that's based on the book, and some things are going to have to be changed, and that's fine. You know, what you want to do when you make the adaptation is not to make it a slavish adaptation to a book, which almost never works well, but make it an intelligent adaptation that leverages the strengths of the film medium to tell the story that is basically you know, the same story, just in a different medium, and to make it something that actually lives in that particular medium as well as in the book. So that is probably the best and most useful thing that I've gotten out of having been a film critic when it's come time to be like an executive producer and so on and so forth. I would still like to be able to, at some point or another, write you know, a script or a screenplay. I did, in fact, just for the exercise of it, write an adaptation of my novella, The Dispatcher, as a screenplay, and sent it off, obviously, to my agent and to a couple other people who are screenwriter friends, and just was like, tear this apart, tell me what I did wrong, because I want to know what's going on with it. And the good news is that most of the response to it was positive. So it's something that I think I would like to be able to do. But in the meantime, I have these other advantages that come from having been a film critic and following the film industry for so long.
There's an alien life form making frequent comments in the background.
more than one. With it, for the folks at home, Spice, who is about 3 years old, is now looking out the window at birds. And Smudge, who is our newest kitten, who is about 3 months old, is basically lurking in the background waiting to attack Spice, and then Spice will get very angry and smack Smudge around, and Smudge will run off, and then the cycle will repeat itself because kittens.
Well, it's funny to hear in the background. So going back to the novel, you had it written. What is your rewriting process like? And what things do you find yourself concentrating on doing during the revision process?
I don't rewrite.
You don't rewrite at all?
Nope.
Even under editorial suggestion, do editors suggest?
Well, no. I mean, if my editor comes back and says you need to change this, I will look at it. But basically, and there's an explanation here, which is two things are working here. The first is that as a former journalist, where basically you have to write a couple thousand words, you know, every few days, and it's all due at 3 p.m. And you have to write clean copy or the copy editors will come over and strangle you. I learned to get very organized in my thoughts as I was writing pretty quickly, so that most of what I write just simply by that repetition of years and years of journalism is fairly clean copy. The other thing is the revision process. In many ways, is dictated by the instruments that people use. When you were writing by hand or when you were writing on a typewriter, you had to do drafts because you couldn't go back like you can with a computer and make edits and changes in sort of live time while you were writing. Well, I've only ever written on a computer. The very first short story I ever wrote was on a, you know, first-generation Macintosh back in like 1984. My process has never been write it out, then do another draft to clean up. It has always been write it, and while you're going along, if you need to make changes, go ahead and make changes, and then You know, so it's a rolling draft. It's a, you know, a fractal draft is what one of the things that I call it. So by the time that I get to the end, so much of what would have been first drafts or second drafts or whatever has already been subsumed in the writing process. So I can just do a quick check to make sure that all the punctuation is in the same place and send it off. And like, for example, The Consuming Fire, which is the book that is the sequel to The Collapsing Empire and which will come out in October. Basically, what I ended up doing with that is it was due June 17th. And 7 a.m. on June 17th, I basically typed the last words to it. I read the last page to make sure I get all my punctuation right. And then I immediately just sent it off. And so there was no revision going on. And then when I got the comments back, the comments were very short. And basically, a couple lines said, could you tweak this? Could you fix that? And it basically took less than 20 minutes to make those changes. But that's only because all the time while I was writing, I was also doing drafting and editing. So when I say that I don't rewrite, it's not that I don't do my rewrites. I just do them while I'm doing the initial manuscript, and I don't then do a look at the finished thing and tweak from there.
Was there a lot of or any research involved in this one? If so, what's your research process?
A lot of the research, the good news is that we live in a time where doing research is super easy. I don't know if you've heard of this thing that's called the internet.
Vaguely.
Have you heard of it?
Vaguely.
Vaguely.
It only recently made it to Saskatchewan. So.
Well, it's a hard scrabble life up there in Canada, I understand. But so the internet makes it super easy to find even the smallest of things. You have to be intelligent about it, and this is part of where the philosophy degree comes in. So being able to evaluate the source, to find confirming information elsewhere, so on and so forth. But so much of my research does not require me to even move from my desk. You go to the internet, you find stuff, you go, okay, this is enough information for me to go on, whether if it's about physics or science or something like that, or about a particular location. For the interdependency books, I do a lot of looking at various place names that I give the systems and the cities within the systems. And so that leads me through a trek through Wikipedia and the CIA fact book and stuff like that. So so a lot of the research that would have taken so much more time, even 20 years ago, is something that you can do in a matter of minutes.
And you can do it while you're writing, which is like you're in a scene and you need something and you look it up and it's there and you put it in the scene and you just carry on.
That's exactly right. And that's something that has, again, always been part of my process. Because, again, by the time that I started writing novels, which was in 1997, the internet, while not as we know it today, was still robust enough that so much of what I could was, you know, just sort of available in the fingertips. The other thing is that so much of what I write is not about me going out and finding stuff. It's about me reading something that I find super interesting or thinking about that's super interesting and then writing about it. So way back when I started thinking about ocean currents, right, and how they relate to, you know, European colonialism. You know, I just basically did a whole lot of reading for, I mean, that came out because I had been doing just a whole lot of random reading about, you know, various European countries. And why I was doing reading on various European countries is because that's me. I sometimes will just be like, oh, here's something I'm thinking about. Let's find out what it says on Wikipedia about that. Use Wikipedia as the launching pad to go and find out about, you know, the Magyars or something like that. And one thing leads to another. And then I start thinking about ocean currents and, you know, all that information. So that's in many ways, a lot of the researches or a lot of the things that I want to write about are already resident in my head or already I know where to get the information about them. So when I go to write about them, it is not a difficult to find that information because I've already looked at it before.
This is where I explain the why this is called the World Shapers and not World Building, because I want to get your comment on the way my thinking. I want you to give your opinion on my opinion.
Okay.
The reason that I call this world shaping rather than world building, I've always thought that world building was a little too grand because none of us are creating an entire world from scratch in 7 days or however long you might wish to spend on that. But rather, what we are really taking is always the stuff that we've read, as you've talked about, our own experiences, and we shape it into something that is different from our world, but it's still really we're starting with the real world and shaping it into something else. That's why I'm calling this world shaping, and I've been asking everybody I've interviewed if you think that's a reasonable thing to call it, and if you feel that is the process, that we're not really building things from scratch, we are compositing things and rearranging them to create something that is new but still relates in some way to the real world.
Well, everything's Hegelian, isn't it? Right? Thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? So when we are world building, as you say, what we are doing is taking things that we already know, taking things that are already familiar, taking things that we already have as kind of given. We are introducing new, highly speculative, highly, hopefully, interesting elements to it. We're mashing them together and we're finding out what comes out the other end of the process. So for me, I think that you're correct that we are taking pre-existing material and we're adding it to our own speculations. And we do that for a number of reasons. One, simply because that's the way a lot of people just work and think anyway, creatively speaking. You have years and years and years of reading in a genre or years and years and years of listening and performing a particular type of music or whatever. And then you use that information as a springboard to, go on to something else. For me, it's non-controversial, but I don't know that it's necessarily shaping or building. I don't know that that's necessarily a distinction with a difference. I mean, I think that you do build. Shaping is part of building. So for me, I would probably say that I think both terms are equally applicable. And I think the issue here might be degree rather than kind. It's very difficult for anyone to develop a wholly new world, right? Because if you're going to do that, you're probably not going to be able to sell that particular piece of work. There's not going to be any hook for readers or people experiencing that work to get into it. And that's the other aspect about what we talk about when we talk about world building or world shaping, which is that we are all doing that more or less in service to a commercial genre. Well, many of us are writing because this is what we want to do for a job, or this is what we want to do in a profitable sense. And in order to do that, not only do we have to, think about what we want, but we also have to think about what others want. We have to think about what it is editors want, because they're going to be the ones who buy our stuff if we are going to go the traditional publishing route. If we're going the self-publishing route or, beyond just the editors and the traditional route, we have to think about what readers will want, something that's going to be able to draw them in. If you go, I mean, there's a reason why McDonald's is hugely popular and molecular gastronomy is basically a niche product, right? Because the number of people who want a hamburger is much larger than the number of people who really want to question the nature of what is on their plate, whether it's food or not. And there's a place for both of them, but you have to understand, where it is that what it is that you're aiming at. I'm not saying that science fiction is hamburger and something else is molecular gastronomy. There's the whole range within the speculative field, but you do have to understand that if you are hoping to be a commercial artist, whether it is with writing or whether it's with television or whether it's with music or whatever, part of what generally, there are always exceptions, but part of what generally brings people in, at least initially, is some aspect of familiarity that they can hook in. The very first novel that I sold and which did very well was the Old Man's War book. And Old Man's War, the elevator pitch of it is Starship Troopers with old people, right? It is a Heinlein juvie with senior citizens. And that was intentional because when I started writing it, part of the mission brief of Old Man's War was, this is a book I want to sell. And so I went and I looked at what was popular in science fiction at the time, which was, as far as I could see, military science fiction. And so I said, all right, I'm going to write a military science fiction book on my terms. I'm going to give people what they want, and then I'm going to give myself what I want, and we're going to see how that works out. So in many ways, this is a perfect example, I think, of what you would say is world shaping, which is that I took essentially Robert Heinlein's blueprint and I built my own house on it and decorated it, you know, in my own style, and then invited people in. They're like, this house looks familiar. And I'm like, yes, it does.
And one of the interesting things you mentioned, of course, that you do take commercial considerations into account, but presumably you write for reasons other than to make money, because the making money, although it's worked out fairly well for you, you know, doesn't work out for everyone.
Right.
So why do you think people write, and why specifically do you write? Why do you want to tell these stories?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, I don't think there's one reason why people write other than there's always the substrate of self-expression, that they have some reason that they want to express themselves. But I think after that, things get varied very quickly. I mean, I'll give you an example. It's like, I never once wrote in a journal, right? Like, people would give me journals because, you know, as I was growing up, because they were like, you seem like the kind of kid who would have a journal, right? And it's absolutely true that I am exactly the sort of kid who would keep a journal, and yet I never kept one. And the reason for that was I already knew what I was thinking. I didn't need to write it down, right? I only started writing when I had an audience. So for me, writing has always been an extroverted act. You know, it has always been not just for myself, you know, but primarily for other people to read. So for me, the ego gratification of it, the ability to make people feel things that I wanted them to feel through the power of words, the ability to persuade or to argue in a way that I couldn't in other formats or in other ways. And also simply because this was, you know, something that was fun and, relatively speaking, easy for me to do. You put those all together. And for me, it was, this is the thing that gets me attention, that people really like, that I could actually do and make a living out of. Sign me up. And the thing is that my own personal outward-facingness of my writing has been there since day one. And I think a lot of people aren't necessarily like that. I think people do like entertaining other people, but I think a lot of people, when they start writing, they do it because of the joy of the act in of itself. And while I certainly do that, that's a small component as opposed to the larger picture. I mean, I play guitar, and I'm terrible at it, but I love it. I'm not going to inflict it on most people, but it's something that I do for myself. So I get the idea of doing things for yourself just for the joy of doing them. Photography is the same sort of way for me. But writing for me has always been about making a connection with other people. And not just making a connection with other people, but influencing them in a particular way. Making them feel, making them laugh, making them cry, making them get angry when I feel angry. All of these sorts of things. So for me, it's really externalized motivation in many ways.
Yeah, I've always felt that way too. I mean, I tried to do the journal thing. I think the last time I tried it was when I watched Doogie Howser, MD, and I watched him typing those, you know, wonderful journal entries, which of course mm-hmm. were written by some writer behind the scenes. And I thought, well, that looks like something that somebody like me ought to do, although I was quite a bit older than Doogie Howser, even at the time that was on television, because I'm 10 years older than you are. But I tried, and a couple of other times I tried, and it quickly turned into, well, my mother's diary, which was got up, made breakfast, wrote some letters, you know, it was strictly just a list of what she did during the day. And I realized this is nothing. This is not what I want to do. So I've always wanted to entertain or to communicate to other people. And when I wrote in high school, I wrote 3 novels in high school, and I shared them with my classmates, and I found out that they actually liked what I wrote, and that was a great reward for me. Well, you mentioned that you like to make people feel things, and you shape these fictional worlds. Do you hope in some fashion that your fictional worlds might shape the real world, or at least shape your readers?
Well, I mean, yes, that would be great. And I do see evidence of that in the sense of two ways. There are people who are scientists and so on and so forth who have looked at some of the stuff that I've done. Particularly, the one thing that I hear a lot over and over again is stuff like artificial blood, which is a big element of the Old Man's War universe. Mm-hmm. And it either initially piqued their interest, or they were like, well, this is sort of the thing that I do, and they sort of build on that sort of stuff, which I think is one of the great things that science fiction does that not all literature gets to do, which is that people read of something in the, you know, science fiction, they're like, this is cool, I want that in the universe, and then they go out and they build it, right? You know, my favorite example of that is the StarTech phone from Motorola, which looks like a Star Trek communicator mm-hmm. because the engineers who built it were like, I want a communicator.
I miss those flip phones.
I know. It's just like, my God, what are we doing here? So there is some of that. I mean, but the, you know, one of the things is, aside from science fiction, of course, I have that whole other sideline. Before I was a science fiction writer, I was a columnist for a newspaper. I wrote opinion columns on a regular basis. I have, and I've been having the blog, the whatever blog, now for 20 years. It's going to be 20 years this September. That is actually where I see most of, in terms of short-term, immediate argumentation and persuasion, that's where I see basically so much of an actual day-to-day influence. And, you know, two examples of that would be in 2005, after Hurricane Katrina, I wrote a piece called Being Poor, which was talking about the day-to-day experience of being poor in the United States, which I had some experience with growing up. And part of the reason I wrote that was to people were saying, why didn't people leave New Orleans when it was flooding? What were they thinking? And I knew exactly what some of them were thinking. It's like, I can't leave everything. And even if I did leave, where would I go? And, you know, what else do I have waiting for me? So I wrote that piece to sort of explain not how people become poor or why people become poor, but the day-to-day experience of it. And that piece literally went everywhere. It went into newspapers. It's being taught in textbooks, or in classes, and it's put in textbooks, and all that sort of stuff. So that is an example of something that I've seen go far and wide and have an influence on the discussion. The other thing very similar to that is, about 5 years ago, I wrote a piece trying to explain the concept of privilege to people who hate the word privilege, because it just is a word that sets them off. And it was talking about how if life was like a video game, straight white men play at the lowest difficulty setting. It doesn't mean that the game's not difficult. Doesn't mean that you still can't lose. But it means that you get breaks and advantages that other people don't who play on higher difficulty settings. And that piece also not only has gone everywhere, but literally at this point, I hear people using that metaphor, the lowest difficulty setting, where I know that they have no idea where it originally came from. It's mm-hmm. come into the common parlance when discussing basically privilege and intersectionality. And I'm like, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, so in that sort of sense, in the short term, with the nonfiction stuff I do, I get the experience of seeing what I say have some influence. Whether the science fiction has an influence in the long term, it's only been about 15 years or so that I've actually been in science fiction, so it's hard for me to say whether anything that I'm doing is going to have any sort of influence at all. I don't think you really get to figure out whether or not you've been a really significant influence until you've been doing it for 20 or 30 years, and you can see the generations of people who have followed in the genre since you. So, I mean, I certainly have people who have said that, you know, they were reading me when they started writing their own stuff, but in terms of whether any of that's going to be significant or whether it's actually going to shape the field, it's really hard to say. And in some ways, you can't really think about that too much, because if you're sitting there going, what about my legacy? What about my legacy? Then you're not actually going to be focusing on what you're doing now, which is writing stuff that is interesting and entertaining and makes people think today. I mean, I always tell people, if you go back 100 years and you look at the bestsellers of 1918, right? The top 10 books for the United States, at least, there might be one that you've heard of, and maybe one other author that you've heard of, and all the rest of it is like, I have never heard of this. And these were the most popular books of their day, the ones that everybody was talking about. And meanwhile, some books that were not even thought of as significant or interesting in their day have become huge hits. I mean, the perfect example of that was The Great Gatsby. The Great Gatsby wasn't a huge seller when it first came out, but over time it's become this huge influential book and is read in every high school in the United States.
Yeah, my daughter's going to be reading it this grade 12 year that's coming up. So,
right, exactly. So, you know, the whole thing about it is that you absolutely have no way of knowing what you're doing is going to be an influence or not. So in many ways, I just tell people, you know, don't worry about that at all. What you do is you sit there and you write the best work that you can. And if it gets remembered, it's great. If it doesn't, that's fine, because right in the moment, you are doing what you're supposed to do, which is make people laugh or cry or think or be entertained. And that in and of itself is a laudable goal.
I agree with you. So there you go. That's good. So that kind of brings us to the end. Just quickly, what comes next from you, and where can people find you online?
Next thing for me in October will be The Consuming Fire, which is the follow-up to The Collapsing Empire, and that will be out October 16th, and I will be doing a book tour for that as well, and people will be able to find out more about that on my website, which is whatever.scalzi.com, or just go to scalzi.com and I'll take it directly there, or they can find me online on Twitter, twitter.com/@Scalzi.
Yes, you're a reasonably active Twitterer, I would say.
It is true, much to my misfortune. Sometimes I spend too much time on Twitter.
Yeah, those social media things can be a dangerous pastime. It's true.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, John, for coming on the World Shapers. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of another episode of The World Shapers. And just as you can find John Scalzi online in various locations, you can find this podcast. Its home address is theworldshapers.com. It's on Twitter at @TWorldShapers. And you can also find it on Facebook. Just do a search for The World Shapers. You can also find me online. I am your host, Edward Willett, and my website is edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett.com. That second T always gets missed. You can find out about all my books there and even buy them from my online bookstore. You can also find me on Twitter at @ewillett, again, two T's on Willett. And you can find me on Facebook as well. Edward Willett is my fan page on Facebook. Edward.willett, I guess. Once again, thank you for joining me for my conversation with John Scalzi. There are many more great interviews planned for the future on The World Shapers. I hope you will come back and hear more about the creative process of the people who shape the fantastical worlds that we have enjoyed so many adventures in. See you next time. Bye for now.